Session number 17965, Sergeant Major Frederick Beadle, Reel 7.
Sergeant Major Beadle, Reel 7. You said that you had remembered the sequence of fire orders in your day.
Yes. Would you like me to tell you about it? Well, the sequence was formed by the word drink, which indicated designation, range, indication, number of rounds and kind of fire. For instance, designation would nominate the actual party that you wanted to fire on this particular target. The range is obvious. Whatever range you'd judge it to be, you would give that range out to the people who are going to do the firing. Indication is indicating exactly where the target is that you want to bear the fire on, inasmuch that prior to firing, you would have picked out an obvious object in the distance to make your central point, and when you indicate the number of fires, you would name that object. Might be a church, might be a gap in a hedgerow, might be a tree taller than others, but you would nominate that first, then guide your people to the target from that particular point. For instance, you would give the point, look right, 2:10, and you bring the bear to fire on that. Then you come on to number of rounds, which is obvious, the number of rounds you want them to fire, and the kind of fire, whether it be by sight or whether it be rapid fire or what have you. Drink.
Did that form of fire order last all the way through your military career, or were there changes?
No, there were no changes whatsoever. I first instructed in that in 1932 when I was an unpaid active lance corporal, and it was still carried on that way up to the beginning of the war. Don't suppose it would be of any use these days, because the weapons they use these days are a different kettle of fish to what they were in the infantry pre-war, whereas the infantry pre-war had the Lee Enfield, which was reasonably accurate up to 600 yards. These days, it seems to me that the weapons are for close combat rather than a distance such as 600 yards.
When you were operating on the Northwest Front here around Rasmac, up in the hills, did you have any support weapons?
Yes, there was a... Now, I'm not very well up on artillery, but there was an artillery group there. One group had a rather large cannonry that they didn't used to escort us on our forays into the wilds, but they would take up a position outside the camp and cover us for so many miles. Then we had a group of artillerymen who had their guns on mules, and they would go on ahead, out, give covering fire, keep you covered after you'd pass. A very difficult job with mules and the heights they had to cover in order to get a good vantage point.
This sounds rather like a similar activity to that of the pickets, who were holding heights with rifles.
Very similar. In other words, what the commander did was to keep the whole of the brigade safe, or comparatively safe, or free from surprise by covering the route they were going through before they went through there. So, for instance, the infantry would be doing the covering group. They would go out in front of the column as it came along and give them covering fire, whereas the mule section of the RA would probably stay static for a bit because they'd got a longer range that they could fire to. So they would give distance protection as compared with close connection with the pickets.
Did you have any idea what sort of weapons the enemy had?
Oh, yes. as far as we knew, they had no automatic weapons. To the best of my memory, I'd never heard an automatic weapon being used by them. But they all had a similar, if not same, Lee Enfield type of rifle that the infantry used in those days. If you saw a column of even peaceful hillmen going through with their camel collars, that almost every man in the column had a rifle on his shoulder, because it seemed to me when I was up there that they were fighting amongst each other as much as anything else, and that seems to still be going on today, as gone on for many, many years.
Did you have any briefings from your officers or NCOs about the state of affairs in the area you were patrolling and what the nature of the tribesmen was and what they were likely to be doing in the near future?
No, we didn't. No. Not to the best of my knowledge. And we were told where we were going.
Yes.
Did you have... And the only time we were actually told where the enemy was that we were close to them. And we were putting up for the night at that particular spot. But the enemy were close, and it meant that we had to... No shouting, no clanging about, because up in the hills at night, where things are quiet, you'd hear almost everything up to quite a distance. So...
Do you recall hearing other people moving about at night when you were encamped?
No. See, the night system in camp, when you was out on picket, or out on column, rather, was exactly the same as if you stayed in the Razmat camp. Every site we went to had been used before. And whoever got there first, poor devils, they built them all around an area. And that area was big enough to take the brigade. And each unit would have to guard a certain section of the wall that went round in the same way as they did in Razmat camp. So we were never sort of taken by surprise or anything like that. I mean, for instance, on one occasion at night, one of the mules must have got loose, was galloping about, and of course we all got a bit windy about that. We could hear it galloping around, but we didn't see the thing for a bit. In my particular position, we didn't see it at all. It was around the other side of the camp. But, you know, you couldn't be surprised if everybody was doing their job.
You said that you were told where you were going. Did you have... sight of a map so that you had any idea of where it was?
No. No. Never saw a map at all. I think giving out information to the lower ranks was very lax in those days, and life would have been a lot more interesting if we had been taken into the confidence. The only time that the lower ranks got any orders was when you were going into attack, for instance. The battalion commander would give his orders to the company commanders, the company commanders would give their orders to the platoon commanders, the platoon commanders would get the section commanders up, and the section commanders would then go back and give it out to the privates. But outside of that, information was very, very lax. I don't think that side of the army was well run at all in those days. It wasn't catered for it in any courses you did either. For instance, we used to have courses that I had to pass a carder before I was promoted acting unpaid lance corporal. Now, before I was made a full corporal, I had to pass another carder from lance corporal to corporal and so on up to sergeant. But passing information down to troops wasn't done very often. As a joke sometimes, you'd line the whole group up that you was in charge of, whether it be a section or a platoon or what have you, and you would whisper to the right-hand man a message. And they would pass it on man to man quietly until it got to the end of the line. Might be 20 people, might be 30 people. And then you could compare the message that you'd started off with the message you finished up with. You would say, we have arrived at this spot, we are going to advance to such and such a spot, and when we get there, we are going to do this or do that. Very short and brief piece. And it's amazing that the lads used to juggle it around a bit. You got some wonderful results at the end, but it was no good from an army point of view, as far as I'm concerned.
When you were receiving and giving orders, did that always follow a set pattern, a formula, or was there anything ad hoc about the way in which orders were given and passed on?
Well, the only rules that I can remember on it is this passing on from the top to the bottom.
Yes.
That obviously, when you're going into attack or if you're taking up a defensive position, there's something you must tell the lower ranks, because if you've got a platoon commander, for instance, he gets bumped off into the first sort of foray, you've got to get the next in line to go up and take charge of the platoon, and so it goes on. You could finish up with a private. I mean, if he hasn't been told what the situation is to start off, then he'd be no good to carry out the orders as they were designated.
Did you get involved in doing attacks while you were in RASMAC?
No, not at all. We were looking forward to being involved, to be quite honest. We all wanted our Frontier Medal, there's no doubt about that. And the regiment before us had a pretty dicky time. And the regiment that took over from us, the RSM of their regiment, was shot at RASMAC Nur Ayn before he even got there. And both sides, they had active service and got their medals, but the DCLI didn't. We always said they were afraid of us.
It sounds as though you might have hit a slack period.
Yes, it must have been. I can only remember us being fired on one occasion. That was during the night. We were on a plateau overlooking a riverbed, and there was a very steep mountain on the other side of the riverbed, and the firing was from there, and the only damage it did was to hit a poor mule in the leg. But other than that, we had nothing. We were very fortunate, really.
You're saying that you really didn't know where you were going in precise terms, because although you might be told where you were going, you didn't have maps.
Yes.
Did you find that over the year you were at RASMAC, you got to know the country? Did you return to the same places and routes on these column operations?
Yes. I think I could probably go back now and start from RASMAC and find my way around to some of the places. I mean, one place, for instance, that sticks in my mind is Ladder. That is where we lost a mule. Another one is, I've got to shake my memory for this one. I can't remember it. But it was a very bad column. It rained all day when we were marching, and it snowed at night, so that when we woke up in the morning, if we managed to get any sleep, there was about 6 inches of snow on the ground. I can't remember the name of the column now, but I could go there again. I could also go from Banu up to the up to Resmac, because that was a good road all the way up. Some of the places, yes. Some of the places, no.
Roughly how many destinations would there be to which columns would go?
I couldn't answer that, because we were never told. And I suppose it's only a question of going around showing the flag on these columns. I can only think the brigade commander, either on his own initiative or from orders above, went to a certain area. They might know there might be a bit of trouble brewing somewhere or the other, and guide the column to that to protect. But I don't think so. No.
Were they very frequent?
But the columns?
Yes.
Approximately one every couple of months, I suppose. Because if you didn't go out on a 3 or 4 day column, you'd do a day exercise around the Resmac camp. We had three peaks in the mountains up there in Resmac. And they were called the postmaster's daughters, for the sake of something better, I suppose. But going out to there and coming back was a good full day, a hard slogging. You knew you'd done a day's work there.
What form would those exercises take? Would it simply be a march, or would you be practicing?
Oh, you'd be doing your picketing and everything else all the way through, you see. Yeah. I think I mentioned before that our first exercise up there was taken with the Gurkhas.
Yes. This was your introductory training, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yes.
And that we paired up with the Gurkhas. For instance, the section that was an NCO and so many rifles, which is an NCO and 12 rifles. And you'd pick on the Gurkhas, NCO and 12 rifles, and match individuals up. And that was our introduction. Well, of course, I mean, the Gurkhas are mountain people anyway, and they'd been up there some time, and they were a damn sight fitter than we were. By the end of the day, on our introductory exercise with them, we knew we'd done some work. There's no doubt about that.
How did you communicate with the Gurkhas? Did they speak any English?
Very little. We had very little to do, because in those days most of the officers were British anyway, so you always had somebody to fall back on as far as the language was concerned. But from experience of Gurkhas, very few of them were at all good with English. And it's the same thing where I met them. Well, in the Middle East, I was Sergeant Major in the Indian section of the Middle East PT school. And they were a bit backward as far as language is concerned, as compared with the Indians.
Apart from the Gurkhas, who were the other troops at Resmac at that time?
Well, it would be any of the Indian infantry, which you say it a lot. There's a hell of a lot of Indian regiments in India in those days. I wouldn't have any idea how many regiments there were. But there was plenty of regiments to take the places of the Gurkhas.
Do you remember who they were when you were there?
We had the Gurkha regiment. We had, I think it was the Rajputs. I can't remember exactly who they were.
Did you have any contact with them at all?
No, very little. It seemed to me that we tended to keep within our own little group. You was designated at a certain area of the camp as a battalion, and we seemed to stay in that group. We had the Gurkhas on one end of us, and I think it was the RA on the other end of the battalion area. Can't remember exactly. But as before, it was covering the wall, covering every closing every sort of position where you could be surprised by attack.
It sounds as though you were rather busy at Rathmack. How long would a column operation last if you went out? How long would a column operation last if you went out to show the flag?
Oh, 3 or 4 days. Mm. And the only difficulty in those days, I suppose, was water. Literally, you drank what you carried, more or less. I mean, everything was moved by mules, which restricted. But, yes, 3 or 4 days, most of them.
What could you do at Rathmack when you weren't actually working?
Oh, we could play sport. Our Indian contractors were with us, so we had a canteen. We had a cinema. And outside the area of the camp was all the sports grounds that we needed. We had a running track. We had a football pitch. Hockey pitch, obviously. Oh, yes, if you wanted to do those sort of things, they were there laid on for you.
Where did you go next, then, after Rathmack? Where did you go next after you'd finished at Rathmack?
At Dinapore.
What were you doing at Dinapore?
Well, I went with the advance party. I was a full corporal in those days. No, I wasn't. No, I was a lance corporal. And I went with the advance party in order to take over the job of garrison provost corporal.
And how big was the garrison? Was it just the battalion, or did you have other troops as well?
There was only Allier battalion there at that time. With Dinapore, there was two outlets of entertainment as far as the troops were concerned there, and that was Patna, which was quite a big town, and there was a large hospital there with lots of nurses, which was attraction, of course, for the troops who had been up on the frontier for a year and fighting fit when they come down. And also there was a railway club. The railway in those days was more or less controlled by English people, English train drivers or what have you. And in every big town they had a club. And they would lay on dances, etc., for you to attend. And of course within the campgrounds themselves, you had the usual entertainments to occupy your mind. But at Dinapore, it was difficult to get settled, because although we were stationed in Dinapore, we had a company out on the Andaman Islands, another company in Muzaffarpur, another company in the hills in the summer, which didn't leave much of the battalion in Dinapore. Or now and again the headquarters would go up the hills for their and take over from one of the other companies. But
what sort of place was Dinapore?
As stations go, and according to your point of view, I suppose, I would say it was probably one of the best stations we had, because we had this bit more entertainment to entertain ourselves when we were off duty. But although from Dinapore we went to Lahore, which was a very big town, I preferred Dinapore.
What about the facilities for military training at Dinapore?
We had all the necessary things to carry on with our military training, the same as we had anywhere else. Um, probably a bit more, because we were spread out so much, as I've said before, that you did a bit more in the soldiered line than you normally would. So,
was there any hint of trouble in Dinapore? Presumably there was a garrison partly for the point of having, you know, of showing a presence.
No, I don't think so. I didn't quite get your question.
I was asking whether there was any hint of any trouble, political trouble or anything of that sort in Dinapore.
Oh, no. No, we had nothing like that. In any of the stations we were in, although we were prepared for it, should it happen, there were, on occasions, little stirs up in the bizarre areas of towns, but that, they were only local flares up, nothing more than that.
Did you get involved in those at all?
No. No. As far as I know, the battalion from 1929 and 1939, when I was with them, they never ever turned out against any trouble with the Indians.
You said you were prepared for such trouble. What sort of preparations had you made?
Well, we were just informed what we should do and what we should not do. That information, I've got a job to remember, because it was such an infrequent information that we get. But the crux of the thing was you could only fire at the mob when instructed to do so. And before you did fire, the battalion commander had to get a certain legal document signed by the local magistrates. That sort of situation and information was passed down to us.
Do you remember practising riot drills at all?
We never did.
You never did?
No, not at all.
Now, you were the Provost Corporal. What were the duties of the Provost Corporal?
Well, as indicated, I was Garrison Provost Corporal.
Yes.
As compared with Regimental Provost Corporal. The Regimental Provost Corporal did the policing job within the camp. The Garrison Provost Corporal did a policing job outside of the camp, and to areas where the troops were allowed to go and where there was likely to be any problems. So, as the Garrison Provost Corporal, I had, I think it was six men, Garrison policemen, under my command, and we had to keep peace, or call it what you will, in the garrison area, which took in towns like Patna, Dinapore Railway Club, any area where the troops were likely to attend and where there's likely to be a bit of trouble. As you can well imagine, the troops would go to Patna. There was clubs there where they could go and get a drink. Some of them would get a bit tipsy, and in that state they would cause a bit of trouble. But we didn't have a lot of trouble. We had the problems, but not bad ones.
How did you carry out this policing work? Did you have regular patrols in areas, or did you just go out on call?
No, we had regular patrols. So I knew just where the police should be at any time during the night. And we did it by bicycle. Of course, the best of my memory, Patna was something like 7 miles outside the camp, if I remember rightly. I wouldn't swear to that, but it was a good bicycle ride, there's no doubt about that. And we did all our duties riding the bicycle.
Did you go out as a body of six, or did you go out in smaller groups?
In pairs.
Was that sufficient strength to deal with any incident? Was that a sufficient strength to deal with any sort of incident?
Oh, I think so, yes. They would be in pairs. I would be roaming around as a loose end. We had the ground fairly well covered. From there, if you can imagine it, going from Dinapore to Patna, two or three places where there's a few mud huts here and there, but otherwise it was open fields. So you'd concentrate your police on where it's likely to be busiest with troops. Troops will only go where they're going to be entertained, whether it be to a dance, whether it be to a brothel area, whether it be to a drinking club. They'll go to those sort of places. They won't go into open fields.
Did you ever encounter any cases of troops resisting your garrison police?
No, never.
What happened to soldiers who were caught in an incident of some sort?
Caught?
In an incident, if there was a drama and soldiers were involved, what would happen to them?
Oh, they would be tried in the same way as if they'd done something in the camp. They would go